Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind with Lisa Arnone. We are here bringing you ideas, concepts, guests to help you lead a more positively minded life, and we're back. We're back after a month of having special programming. We're back with you with regular schedule. We'll be here Tuesday and Wednesday most of this month. We started a series called Psychology for Therapists. The series was based on the belief that most education in psychology that is addressed to the layperson tones down a lot of the important questions as if we're assuming that people wouldn't understand it. And then I realized when I teach and when I supervise, I speak a different language. So I've worked at universities and I've run classes and I've had supervision meetings. So I decided, or Lisa Arnone actually, said, you know, whenever you teach this stuff, as you teach it, it would make great sense for it to be radio as it is. So we started a series called Psychology for Therapists. And this is giving you the basis of psychology as it would be taught to therapists, which are different than the way it would be taught to the layperson. But what it turns out is that our audience, or the audience here at WBAI, certainly is probably more intelligent and more knowledge-grabbing than most people out there, most therapists especially. So with that in mind, we're going to continue on this series, and today we go to the seventh part of the series. We started this series with the nature of feelings, because at the basis of everything is to trying to identify what it is we feel. Most people, in trying to deal with themselves, are confused. What they feel, why do they feel it, how do they feel it, what is a feeling, what is not a feeling. That was part one. Part two was then you take knowledge and behavior, and you look at those two, and you study your own knowledge, your own behavior, and you integrate that with your feelings. How do you do that? What's the purpose there? And as a therapist, how do you help people do that? Number three was that there's a certain dynamic that affects the process of self-inquiry, which has to do with dependency. So we talked about dependency syndrome and how dependency affects your being able to learn about yourself. This, of course, is very important to therapists as well, because the nature of the dependency between the therapist and the client affects the dynamics of how successful they're going to be in treatment. Number four, were stages of growth and understanding resistance. Stages of growth. So as you begin to learn about yourself, can you expect? For example, if you're depressed and then you become undepressed, the first thing you feel is anxiety. You see, what happens when you're depressed is you quell a lot of life energy. You keep it down. And part of the reason that people are depressed is because they hate being anxious. So depression is an antidote to anxiety, because anxiety makes you feel like you're losing your mind. So depression is what people very often choose. And you can see when people are very nervous, they'll eat a lot of food to depress their bodies. They'll smoke cigarettes. They'll take drinks. They're going to depress themselves. Or you actually get depressed. So one of the stages of growth and understanding resistance is that when you remove depression, when you help a person get undepressed, the first thing they're going to feel is nervous. Energy is going to come back. Unfortunately, the unskilled therapist does not caution the patient that as you get better, you're going to feel this nervousness. And this nervousness is going to manifest as a kind of anxiety that you're not used to, and you're going to feel like pulling your hair out. But that's part of the growth. That's a stage you're going to have to go through, and when you go through that, you're going to have life energy back, and you won't need the depression, and you won't fear anxiety. The skilled therapist will prepare a client for that. The unskilled therapist forgets about it. They don't remember it. So stages of growth is very important. And then understanding resistance, resistance is a phenomenal thing because we all don't want to change. We want to stay the way we are. We want to be successful at what we do. Most people go into therapy not to change, but to be more successful at their neurosis. You know, hey, I want to be able to do better at how I get along with people. Then part five was trying to figure out whether you're crazy or not, discerning pathology. And we called it discerning pathology, meaning what kind of crazy am I and what form does it take and is it neurosis, is it psychosis, is it manic depression? We gave a class on that. Good class. Part six is once you get all this stuff sorted out, how do you begin redirecting your thinking and feeling? Today's part seven. Today's part seven is an education for you on what happens in the therapeutic process, or even if therapy is not something you go into, but just something you do on your own. Because you can successfully work on your own. The trouble with working on your own is you're looking into the mirror with the same eyes that are looking in the mirror. You know, it's very hard to see yourself. That's why it's good to have someone on the outside, not critical of you, who can help you see. But, you know, this is all stuff you can do on your own. So today we're going to talk about the questions that you ask yourself. How your fear blinds you, how you're not knowing the right question to ask gets in your way. This is Armand Amu with Lisa Arnone. We're here with part seven of our series, Psychology for Therapists. We want to, while we're here, we want to remind you of a special thank you to those of you who were part of our fund drive, and let you know right away that calling to fulfill the fund drive, calling my office, is a good time to do it now because we still have some slots open to, and also if you promised money and you haven't paid it yet, please do it. The station needs the money. My office number is 212-757-4488 just to fulfill the requirements. Now, let's talk about the questions. How do you know what question to ask? What question would you ask of yourself? Let's say that you could get time alone with me. And let's say you didn't have a whole bunch of time, but let's say you could ask me one question. Let's say you could ask me a question that I could give you an answer in a fortune cookie or something. I could just give you a nice, simple answer to it. Like you could say to me, why do I always, somebody came to me the other day, whenever I go into a shop, I steal something. Why do I always feel this compulsion to steal something? And so, so we want to lead you in a direction, and we want to lead you in a direction of learning today how to ask questions. And it's in order to go there, I want to be able to direct you to something, and I want you to be able to hear something first that I haven't put on air in a long while. But it's about how you cloud your own vision. This is a precious piece that I collected over the years. I thought you might enjoy. It seems to be appropriate with the London Games that are happening now here. This is for you.
The California coast was shrouded in fog that 4th of July morning in 1952. 21 miles to the west on Catalina Island, a 34-year-old woman waded into the water and began swimming toward California, determined to be the first woman to do so. Her name was Florence Chadwick, and she had already been the first woman to swim the English Channel in both directions. The water was numbing cold that July morning, and the fog was so thick she could hardly see the boats in her own party. Millions were watching on national television. Several times, sharks, which had gotten too close, had to be driven away with rifles to protect the lone figure in the water. As the hours ticked off, she swam on. Fatigue had never been her big problem in these swims. It was the bone-chilling cold of the water. More than 15 hours later, numbed with the cold, she asked to be taken out. She couldn't go on. Her mother and her trainer alongside in a boat told her that they were near land. They urged her not to quit. But when she looked toward the California coast, all she could see was the dense fog. A few minutes later, at 15 hours and 55 minutes, she was taken out of the water. It was not until hours later, when her body began to thaw, that she felt the shock of failure. To a reporter, she blurted out, "Look, I'm not excusing myself, but if I could have seen land, I might have made it." She had been pulled out only a half mile from the California coast. Later, she was to reflect that she had been licked not by fatigue or even the cold. The fog alone had defeated her because it obscured her goal. It had blinded her reason, her eyes, her heart. It was the only time Florence Chadwick ever quit. 2 months later, she swam that same channel, and again fog obscured her view. But this time she swam with her faith intact. Somewhere behind that fog was land. Not only was she the first woman to swim the Catalina Channel, but she beat the men's record by more than 2 hours.
So often we are blocked by our own fog. We can't see what's happening. We can't see what's going on there. We think it's one thing and it's something else. It's asking the question. So Lisa and I have put together a number of questions that we have that are the typical questions that people ask. Like, very often someone will come in and they won't understand something like a biological imperative. You know, why do I get hungry right before I get my period? Why do I get so distracted? A young man was asking me the other day, he's 17, 18 years old. He says, "I couldn't stand it. I was in a room with all these girls," he said, "and I just couldn't take my eyes off them." He said, I just couldn't stop looking. He said, "Everywhere there was a girl, I was looking. He said, "What's wrong with me? What's happening to me?" And he's 18 and coming into pubescence, and this is the biological imperative that's kind of running him at the moment. So you get a sense that there's something wrong with you and there are biological imperatives. Like the sense of smell that we have. We have a sense of smell that helps us discern who may or may not be a proper mate for us. Right? We have pheromones that we could read in other people. And by smelling or by somehow becoming aware of another person's smell, you can judge whether or not they're going to be a good potential mate. That somewhere in the pheromones, you will find whether or not the person has the right genetic structure. This is all the way, I mean, this is so biochemical. It's so tiny that through a whiff of your nose by hugging somebody or even by passing somebody, you can tell, is that for me or is that not for me? And does nature say I should mate with this person or not? And if they have the exact right chemistry, you'll feel yourself drawn to them. Drawn, like, want to have them. So these are things that are beyond reason. They're things that we're born with. Things that help us grow up, things that help us mature, get to a certain point. But then after you get past the biological imperatives, you have a lot of questions about yourself. And there are questions that you could ask, like a typical question that someone would ask me is, why can't I leave my marriage? That's a very big question, don't you think? Well, it's not. It's not the right question. And that's what we're going to work with you today. We want to teach you how to go through the questions that we call, these are level one questions. Level one questions are the questions that people come in asking about themselves. But they're really not about themselves. Why can't I get him to love me properly? Right? Why won't he love me? Things like that, those are level one questions. But there are many more that we have about ourselves.
Well, we were thinking why you would say Why does she never call me? Why do I always feel sad when I go by church or whatever? I mean, it's basically a feeling is in me, but I assume it has something to do with it, something external.
Or it could be, why am I always angry?
Why am I always angry?
Why am I always suspicious? Right? Why can't I stand up for myself? Why am I so impatient? Why do I worry about how I look so much? I have a friend who, whenever she passes a mirror, she must look in the mirror. And it's kind of cute to see. Wherever the mirror is, she's always checking herself in the mirror. Why do I get frustrated over nothing? Why do people hurt me so much? Why do I want to hurt people? So if you ask these questions about yourself, you're asking very important questions. Now you're saying there's something beyond my ken, beyond my knowledge. There's something about me that I don't understand. And I think you may understand it, Armand. So would you please tell me the answer to this? Well, you see, the problem is the question is not the right question. The question is the beginning question. Once you ask the first level question, you have to go down a number of steps. This is Armand DeMille with Lisa Arnone. We're talking about the path of self-inquiry, the steps that you have to take to asking the question. So the question is not, why can't I find somebody to love me, which is what a lot of people ask. And a lot of people say it, you know, if they call in, how can I meet the right person? Well, that's one question, but we have to step down from that. So let's say level one is you ask a question which on the surface seems to relate to other people's behaviors towards you. Level two, the second level of question, is what is the real feeling that I have? So if I take away the feeling of what people did to me, and if I take away my reaction to other people, what is the real feeling that I have? So that means the following questions. Do I feel sad? Do I feel scared? Do I feel fear? Do I feel angry? Or underneath that, what's underneath it? Like if you get angry a lot, underneath anger could be fear, could be sadness, could be a whole bunch of things. So you want to be able to identify the thing that you've originally talked about protects you against. Like for a lot of people, feeling sad is like akin to, you know, dying. And they're afraid of it. They don't want to feel it. The next level is what we call causality. And in this case, this one is really rough. And by the way, we'll be taking your calls a little later at 212-209-2900. This one is now the acceptance of causality. Now, this is a very difficult one. Because in this one, we ask you, a person who's coming in complaining about what they feel, we're asking you to say you want to feel this way. Now, geez, everybody would say, I don't want to feel this way, that's why I'm here. And we say, or I say, no, some part of you wants to feel this way. And you have to identify that. If I'm sad, what does it do for me? If I'm angry, what does it do for me? What does anger do for me? You know, what is it that I want to feel angry? Sure, it makes you safe. Sure, it makes you feel powerful. Sure, if you have some anger, you're going to feel like you could fight. So there is some part of you that wants to feel the way you feel. And this is very important. You have to be able to identify that part. This is where it gets tricky. Because part of what gets in the way here is self-criticism and self-blame. One of the things that people do when they see that they are the one causing all the ruckus, they believe that they've got to stop doing it, or they put themselves down. What's the matter with me? I'm angry. Why am I doing this? And they feel wrong, and they feel like they should beat themselves over the head. One of the things that a good therapist will help you do, or a good friend or a good partner, is they'll say to you, this is what you got. It's okay. It makes sense. Let me not criticize you for that. I don't criticize you, nor will you criticize yourself. Because to criticize yourself will stop your vision. It'll stop you from seeing. So here's a great question for all of you out there. You have a feeling. You don't like the feeling, but you create the feeling. Meaning that some part of you, unconscious to you, creates the feeling. I feel betrayed. Why? How did you pick that partner? Right? So a man I know is going out with a woman who's married, and she's married, and he's going out, and he's having a relationship with her, and then finally she gets unmarried, and now he gets her, and he takes her in as his private, and he marries her. And now he's married, and she finds out she's cheating on him. Well, listen, this is how it started. It started on that she was with another man, and she was with you. So you have chosen somebody that has given you the same result of feeling unloved, betrayed. You carefully selected.
I'm thinking about it from the standpoint of someone who thinks of themselves as a caretaker, and they feel great pride in their ability to take care of somebody else. But as time goes by, a sense of, seemingly from nowhere, anger and resentment starts to arise. And it would take a process for a person to understand that their own needs might be missing from that formulation.
Or their needs are present, but suppressed on purpose.
Right, and they are doing something that is reflective of how they think of themselves, but not reflective of how they feel. I'm a caretaker. Does that mean I never want anyone to take care of me?
Yes. Interesting, right? That would mean, now we're going down to level 6. See, on the first level, what you say is very important. I'm a caretaker, but I want somebody to take care of me too. And I'm going to quote my friend who said to me one day, he said, I'm a caretaker, but I want the opposite of that. I want someone to take care of me. I said, the opposite of taking care of people is not having them take care of you. The opposite is to stop taking care of them. You see, if you take care of somebody all the time, the opposite of that is you don't take care of people all the time. Not you have them take care of you. So part of it may be that you want to be taken care of, but part of it may be that you don't, and that goes down another layer. This is where having a therapist like you, Lisa, or having somebody who could really help a person dig in, they go down the layers. Now, what's the idea of this? Why do we want to do it? We want to do it because I don't want to be a mystery to myself. Because I don't want to be pulled out of the water just because I can't see the shore. I want to be able to see myself as best I can. The question here is, of course, is trying to, number one, accept this causality of my mind. Oh, no, you mean I really want to feel this miserable? Oh, no, you mean I really want to be this fat? Oh, no, I really want to be alone? Could that possibly be true? And when you find it out, it's a celebration. It's not what you think, this dooming news. Oh, my, what's the matter with me? I'm so bad. I'm so horrible. I really want to be alone. No, it's really like a celebration. I think therapy should have little celebrations that they do when people have insights.
Right, because when you find it out, then you have a choice. Then you actually have a choice about what it is you decide to do next.
And the truth of it is, when you find it out, choice shouldn't even be considered. You should just be happy to find it out, because it helps you unravel your entire past. It helps you unravel where you stand. Now, the assumption is that once you find out a dysfunctional thing about yourself, you may consider an alternative. Well, you may, but it may not be worth it. And I talk about the man who came to see me, who was 80 years old, who thought he was Napoleon Bonaparte. And he truly thought he was Napoleon Bonaparte. And it was a sad case. He came in and his family brought him in. And when they brought him in, he would talk to me and he said, I don't know what I'm doing here. My horse is downstairs. I have to leave here. Josephine is waiting for me. What am I doing here? And I looked at him and I looked at the way he was. He had constructed in his fantasy a complete picture of being Napoleon Bonaparte. And he was powerful and he was weak. He was sick. He was elderly. So when he left, I spoke to his family and I said to his family, okay, here's what we have. We have he's completely delusional. This is called psychotic, and we have the following. We could either give him medication or we could talk him into seeing reality. But if he saw reality, he would see a very poor picture compared to what he sees now. And maybe we want to let him be this way and be who he is, since he seems to feel pretty good the way he is. And that was kind of the way they decided to stay with him. He lived just 3 more years. But in the 3 years that he lived fairly happily on his horse. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. So once you accept your causality, you find out what your payoff is. You find out what is the reason that I'm doing all this. And what's the payoff? What's the goodies about it? Like, for example, why do I always pick people who betray me? Right? Because I really want to be alone. I really want to be alone. Now, this is a giant question. Could anybody really want to be alone? Are there any people in the world who are truly loners? I say that if you wind up alone at the end of your life, you chose to be alone. You could say, no, my husband died, it was, November, but if you're in that state of mind, what if it's a choice? What if it's a place you want to be, right? What would it be like to celebrate this? What would it be like to say, okay, here I am? And then finally, the question underneath the question is, what are the alternatives? What choice can I make? What if I don't want to be alone? Shall I go on the website and start looking up finding a mate? Is it worth it? Because once I identify that I am what I am, and I've chosen to be that way, maybe I'll choose to stay that way. All of that, I think, is the value of inquiry. This is Armand DeMille with Lisa Arnone here. We're talking to you about trying to identify the questions that get underneath the questions, and it is very, very difficult to do it on your own, but you can. I don't believe that psychotherapy is the only answer, nor do I believe psychotherapists are smart enough to stay on track and ask the right questions, because they want to talk just as much as you do about what happened in your life last week. They'll stay on the surface. But the real mechanic, the real therapist, will dig in with you. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little special music, and then we'll continue our phone call, we'll continue our program, and we'll be taking your phone calls at 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. We'll be right back.
New York.
La saveur de la terre, la lueur d'une lune claire. Je n'ai rien que dans le cœur, l'immensité du ciel ouvert. J'ai la fraîcheur d'une rivière, la colère du typhon. J'ai l'amour d'une mer.
pluie, je pleure au torrent qu'en voyant la souffrance d'autrui.
Trop de choses à la fois se font des routes dans ma tête, alors je ne sais plus rien.
Sauf que pour toi, je creusais de nouveaux sillons, mélodie de l'univers.
Caracol. Here's an interesting quote that someone sent through Facebook that I thought would be you'd appreciate. And this has to do with independent artists that are out there who support the WBAI and are part of WBAI. So I thought I would read it to you today. Here it is. When you buy from an independent artist, by Joy Plett, by the way, P-L-E-T-T. When you buy from an independent artist, you're buying more than just a painting or a novel or a song. You're buying hundreds of hours of experimentation and thousands of failures. You're buying days, weeks, months, years of frustration and moments of pure joy. You're buying nights of worry about paying the rent, having enough money to eat, having enough money to feed the children, the birds, the dog. You aren't just buying a thing, the object. You're buying a piece of heart, part of a soul, a private moment in someone's life. Most importantly, you're buying that artist more time to do something they are truly passionate about, something that makes all of the above worth the fear and the doubt, something that puts the life into the living. It's by Joy Plett. You know, it reminds me about buying from local dealers as well, local people, you know, in your neighborhood. If you could support the stores around you, just think about how much it means, what a difference it makes. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Do you know that if you take a laxative before you go to bed, that you are going to have a significantly different dream state, mood, and you're going to wake up feeling differently, not only from the laxative, but your body at night while you sleep. If you put it through a regimen that says take all of the water that's in the body and I want you to direct it to the bowel where I want it to accumulate on the bowel so when I wake in the morning, I'll be able to flush myself out better. You're giving a message to your body and you're saying to your body, do this work overnight. Well, what do you think your body and your dreams, how are they going to relate to the fact that you're giving them this job? It's going to affect you in some way. Let's say you drink before you go to bed or you have some alcohol before you go to bed and the alcohol wears off in the middle of the night and you have a whole kind of sobriety that comes back after the alcohol. How does that affect you at night? Everything we do in some way is going to affect our mood. Are moods physical? Yes, just as much as they are just purely emotional. There's a physical component to every feeling. So the best we could do is identify what a feeling is by identifying it purely as a feeling. And you could learn more about that from the first by replaying the archive program number one in this series, The Psychology for Therapists. So everything we do has an effect, or every the weather will have an effect, and the temperature will have an effect, and the rain will have an effect, and the allergies will have an effect on your feelings. So feelings are not isolated. They're not pure. It's not purely emotional. There is no such thing. What's purely emotional for one person will not be purely emotional for another. What will affect one person a certain way? They had to remember one of the studies where they had women in a big show place were sitting. They were told to sit on certain seats in a theater, and they were isolated to be on these seats in a theater. And then the women were removed, and they brought in young adolescent men, and they said, "Okay, men, sit wherever you want." And they were like 80%. They sat on the same seats that the women sat on, not because they were choice seats for viewing, but some chemical messenger directed them there. Some physical chemical messenger, something as thin as the tiniest molecule in the air, will direct you. Telephone number here is 212-209-2900. The question I have about you, the question I'm asking you, is what question do you have about yourself? What question do you have about yourself? What are you curious about in you? Why do I, is the question that starts. Now, I'm not going to answer your question. I'm going to show you a direction of how to take this question and point this direction, this question, in a direction that you may be able to find an answer. In Buddhism, there's a thing called a koan, K-O-H-N. It's a lovely idea. It's the idea of hanging a question in the air so that the question itself, by being asked, leads you in the direction, not of an answer, but leads you in a direction that completes the question. So, for example, in Buddhism, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Is a koan. It's like there is no answer to this thing, but the very thought of it, or the very idea of it leaving it, suspending in the air, brings you to a certain level of understanding. 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls.
Not yet.
212-209-2900. So if you could ask yourself questions, what would the question be? What kind of question would you go for?
Well, I would say if I found myself making a mistake over and over again, something that was clearly wrong for me, made me unhappy,
Or resulted in unhappiness.
Then okay. I would be curious about what was leading me to go in that direction.
Yeah, why am I always late, for example, right? Mm-hmm. You have meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I always late? And then you ask yourself, but I'm not late. It's the car. It's the traffic. It's the train. It's the subway. It's, you know, you could keep blaming and blaming and blaming. And we know, through having been around this for a long period of time, that we've taken shortcuts. We as therapists have taken shortcuts in the understanding of it.
Ready.
So we call lateness a passive-aggressive behavior, and we know from having seen many people who were late that they have a difficulty expressing anger, and we know that being late for events is a way of passively expressing your anger, because in effect the people who are waiting for you get screwed, you know, and it's not your fault because the dog ate the homework, because the subway was wrong. So we know that as therapists, but we don't tell that to somebody. We don't say, here's the reason why you do it. We hope them step down through the questions to find the real question about why am I so angry. 212-209-2900. Let's take a call. This is Armand DeMille. You're on the air. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
I was diagnosed as bipolar manic depression, and I've come to consider whether or not that there is such a diagnosis. I've been on medication for almost all of my life, and I was told that, you know, that this disease, I don't call it a disease, but a disorder, is incurable, and that I would have to be on medication for the rest of my life. I stopped taking the medication, and I have had so much experience in and out of hospitals, my own knowledge of what I have read of Freud and Winnicott and Jung and people, and of course my experience with psychiatrists and therapists. So, and my own belief that, you know, to know one's own self is part of the way that one can cure one's own self. And I feel like I've come to the point in my life, you know, I'm at an age that I've lived through a lot, and I've reflected a lot, that I feel that that if I'm not cured, I'm certainly well adjusted. I don't want
that's a good that's a very good way of seeing it, by the way. What's your name?
My name is Harriet.
Meredith?
Harriet.
Harriet. Harriet, that's brilliant. Well adjusted is a very interesting question. So if it, let's say that you've had your whole life that you were somehow when you were born, they gave you the wrong chemicals in your brain, and you wound up with this kind of bipolarity, this separation of what they used to think it was a separation of the right brain and the left brain, and that somehow you and many other people wind up with this. And then we, because we could sell you a medication or because we could build a field called psychiatry or we could write books about it, we give it a name, bipolar. And then we say, yeah, you're sick because you have this unusual chemistry, and we treat it accordingly. And then you, after a while, after being through it, you say, well, wait a minute. I know my depression. I know my mania. I know how bad I could get. I know I've been in and out of hospitals. I know I could stop all that by taking medication or by doing things. But I'm also so familiar with myself that I don't believe I'm in true danger. Therefore, I will live with it. Is that accurate?
Absolutely.
Now, see, that's the beauty. There's the beauty right there. At that point, you take 80% of the pressure off the bipolarity because you're not fighting against it.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
I didn't hear that last point.
Okay, at that point, you've taken 80% off the power of the bipolarity to upset you because you're aware of it, you see it, you accept it, and you're not fighting it. It's the fight against it. It's the fight against the depression. It's a fight against the mania. It's all of that that makes you so crazy.
Yes.
So you're what you call adjustment. You're well adjusted to your quote disorder. Takes away the power of the disorder. I don't even think you could call it bipolarity anymore. You know what I mean? So I think you're one of the people. And it took age. It took time.
Yes.
It took muscle. It took understanding. For you to get to a point where you could love yourself a little bit the way you are.
Yes, that's how I. How I see it.
That's really nice. Let me ask you something. You said age took you to a certain place. Because, you know, age does a different thing as well. Not only is it age and experience, but age also changes the metabolism. And sometimes just in the shift in metabolism, the very chemical basis of the bipolarity disappears. But you'd never know it if you were taking medication to keep it controlled all your life. So you've done a very courageous thing that is sounds to me like it's having a good payoff. What's your worst moment like? Harriet, are you still there?
She's gone.
Okay, sorry, Harriet. 212-209-2900. If you call us back, we'll get you back on the air, hopefully. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Armand.
Hi there.
Hi. My call is a bit related to the last caller's. I've never been diagnosed with depression, but I'm 52 now, and I from I've known myself, it has always seemed to be a struggle to, you know, to fight depression. You know, I always ask myself, why is it so hard? Why do I always have the glass half empty feeling? You know, it's a struggle to just be positive. And it just comes so naturally for me to see the dark and gloomy side of life. I always ask myself why. I feel as if I wasn't born to be in this world. It seems like such a struggle to survive, and it has always seemed that way to me, and I'm 52 now.
Sure, and one question that you've had is, you're asking the question, why do I always see the dark side?
Yes.
And I'm saying that's the beginning in a series of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because also you like to be unique, don't you?
Yes.
Right, let me ask you something about the clothing that you choose to wear.
Mm-hmm.
Are the clothing you choose to wear generally different than everybody else's?
Yes.
Okay, how do I know this?
Well, not clothing, but... Well, different.
Go ahead.
In terms of color. I like bright colors
exactly.
That stand out, yes.
Exactly, because you're your own person.
Yes.
And in many ways, you are your own person.
Yes.
And so people...
I'm learning more and more that I am, yes.
Yes. Now this goes somewhere along with the depression.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we ask the questions, as we would take you down through the questions, we would start going to, okay... What am I? I am depressed. What else am I besides the depression?
Mm-hmm.
And there would be a series of questions that would unfold, which relate to your need for your individuality. Because this is, I've seen this for so many years that I know how to point the direction.
Okay.
Because it's very hard to see it on your own, but you've got a big start. The big start is that you know that your depression is based on a mood that is your mood, and it's not based on reality. It's
yes,
not based
yes,
on
yes,
the world
right,
being
yes.
dark.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on a perception of the world.
That's right, yes.
That's terrific.
Yes.
That's a great beginning. And if you take...
It has taken some time.
What did you say?
It has taken some time, Armand. That's a beginning at 52.
That's nothing. You got a long time to get there, and you certainly have a wonderful laugh.
Thank you.
Okay, nice to talk to you,
same
too.
Same here. Thank you so much.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Harriet, are you back with us?
This is Harriet again.
Hey! Isn't that magic? How do you feel right now, Harriet?
Well, actually, I have been feeling better in the last month, I would say, than I've ever felt in my life. Not only, I think, because I've come to term with what others term my illness, but because I've come to term with myself and my relationship to me and to the rest of society. The other thing is I don't really understand what people call mental illness, because what I see in American society is structural illnesses that have to do with the society itself.
Okay, wait. Let me hold you right there, Harriet, okay? Yes, we could go into that political discussion, but I don't do that right now. Mine is going to be a focus on you. In this society, it's almost insane to be sane. So let's put that aside for a moment. You, Harriet, are feeling better. And the reason I asked you, what are you feeling now? I asked you, what are you feeling now? And you told me what you were feeling this month.
Oh,
what
right.
were you feeling right now as you right got now? Back on the air, as you dialed us back and you got back on?
I feel great, actually.
Yes, let's talk about that. Okay, let's talk about that for a moment.
I feel that that you have affirmed, you know.
Okay, that's the reason you feel great, but could you describe the feeling itself to me? Do you feel sweaty?
No.
Do you feel light? Do you feel... Tell me, describe your physical feeling to me. Describe it.
I feel energetic.
Good.
And I feel healthy. I have lost weight from my weight.
Okay, that's in the past. I'm trying to take you right now, right now, this minute.
Right now, I feel energetic, healthy, and I want to write a poem.
And you feel motivated.
Motivated.
And you feel in some way creative.
Yes.
and in some way you like yourself.
Yes.
And you could write a poem to you if you wanted to. You could write a poem to Harriet. And if you were writing a poem to little Harriet, what would you say to her right now? Doesn't have to be poetic, it could be prosaic. What would you say to little Harriet, who has got this whole world to go through, but she's this little kid sitting inside of you who's been waiting for this moment her whole life, which is the moment where you get straightened out enough that you could finally be there for her?
That despite everything that you may have been through, the world is a glorious place, and it's a matter of opening one's eyes and one's mind, and the doors of perception, and that the best way of keeping it in mind that it's beautiful is by feeling it within your own self.
So you're saying to little Harriet, instead of teaching her, tell her the following. Say, little Harriet, I found you. I'm going to hold you in my arms, and I'll show you the beauty of life, because I'm going to remember all of these things about life, and you, my dear child, can relax because you're safe for once. That's what Harriet's saying. That's your poem.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks so much for calling in, Harriet.
Thank you.
This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind with Lisa Arnone. We will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. with more of this exciting stuff. Special thanks to all you people out there.